This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Douglas Tallamy's book, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. And from the prologue, he writes, "Oaks support more forms of life and more fascinating interactions than any other tree genus in North America." I've read parts of October, November, December, and January. I'll read parts of the February chapter today. February may be the quietest time of year for the oaks in our yard. Their acorns have dropped. Most of the caterpillars hiding on oak bark and branches have already been eaten, and many of the mammals that visit our oaks in good weather are asleep in hibernation, and it's often the time of year that snow lies deepest beneath our trees. Inside our house, though, spring fever runs high. Each day the sun rises earlier in the morning and sets later in the day. Our chickadees, titmice, and Carolina wrens start singing their spring songs on warmer days, and seed catalogs appear in our mailbox. All this invariably triggers great planning sessions where Cindy and I discuss new goals for our property, goals we never quite meet, but they're fun to talk about anyway. I'm assuming other people use February for yard plans, too, which makes this a good time to address common misgivings about using oaks as landscape trees. Oak misconceptions. What gives many people pause about planting oaks is the immense size of many oak species when fully mature. I can't tell you how many times people have told me they can't plant an oak because the yard simply isn't big enough. And he goes on to suggest that there are smaller oaks, something called the dwarf chinkapin oak in our area. And then he says, let's say you have a yard that can handle a larger oak species. Will the roots of that oak lift up your driveway or sidewalk? Again, this can happen if you choose a species with a shallow root system, like willow oak. But many oaks send their roots deep enough so that they do not lift up hardscape. And he suggests northern white oak, northern red oak. And then he writes, are oaks too expensive? When you make the classic mistake of buying a large tree, they surely are. But an acorn is free, and a seedling is only a few dollars. I'm not recommending that you forego instant gratification and start small just to save money, although for many of us, that's a darn good reason. I am recommending that you start with the youngest oak you can find, because you will end up with a far healthier tree that will catch up with and even outstrip in size any larger specimen in short order. When you buy a large tree, and by large I mean 1-inch caliper or more, the tree cannot be moved without being severely root pruned, or if it has been grown in a pot, its roots are wound around each other so tightly that they will strangle each other as they grow. These precious roots, which allow oaks to grow well each year, outcompete other young trees, withstand serious drought, and fight disease, are chopped literally to within an inch of the tree's life or bunched into an unnatural tangle that will considerably shorten the life of the tree. Large transplants have a 50% chance of dying within the first few years, and if they do survive, they spend over a decade allocating most of their growth resources toward rebuilding their lost root system. In contrast, young oak trees lay down a large root system, among the largest in the plant kingdom, which will support rapid growth and health for the rest of the oak's life. In just a few years, a young tree with an undisturbed root system will catch up with a much larger transplant or potted tree and exceed it in size. What's more, it will enable you to experience, enjoy, and appreciate its transformation from tiny seedling to dominant tree in your yard. But will your oak eventually fall and cause property damage or worse? With increasing news coverage of trees toppling during storms and more frequent and stronger storms each year, it would be easy to conclude that disaster is lurking behind every tree in your yard. The fact is, large trees do cause disasters on occasion, but there is much we can do to minimize or even eliminate the risks that residential trees pose. One obvious solution is to avoid planting trees that will eventually grow large near the house. As logical as this is, the result would be a treeless zone 100 feet wide around every building, a practice with serious downsides. It would eliminate the cooling effects trees provide in the summer and the warming effects they can provide in the winter. And much of that treeless zone would probably end up as lawn, a landscape use that destroys watersheds, does not support pollinators or food webs, and in short, offers little to no ecological value. Grass is our poorest plant choice for storing carbon. Fortunately, there is an alternative. Plant tree groves rather than specimen trees. Because trees grown in isolation without competition from other trees for light, water, and nutrients usually grow more massive, achieve a larger crown, and present a grander aesthetic than trees that grow close to other trees, we almost always plant trees as isolated specimens. But this practice invites the very disasters we pray will never happen. In most treed areas of the country, trees grow in forests, not by their lonesome, yet each member of the forest is a bit smaller than it would be on its own. Yes, each member of the forest is a bit smaller than it would be on its own, but it is also far more stable. Trees that grow at a spacing found in most forests interlock their roots, forming a continuous matrix of large and small roots that is extraordinarily difficult to uproot. When the big winds come, grouped trees may lose a branch or two, or in the extreme winds of a hurricane or a tornado, their trunks may even snap off some feet up from the base, but they rarely blow over entirely. With this in mind, an easy way to reduce the risks from tree falls in your yard is to plant trees in twos or threes, maybe on a 6-foot center, creating small groves that the eye will take in as if it were a single tree. Trees planted in this fashion weave that stabilizing web of roots that will hold them upright even in extreme weather. There is a catch, however. You have to plant such trees when they are young. In fact, the smaller the better. This way, your trees will have every opportunity to interlock their roots as they grow. So now we have two excellent reasons to plant your oaks and other tree species as well, as small as you can. They will be healthier trees that grow much faster than large transplants, and they will have the opportunity to interlock their roots with close neighbors, reducing future risks to life and property. And I'm going to interrupt and mention that I often pass on Highway 61, north of Mount Zion and south of Soldier's Grove, on the west side of the road on the ridge. There are two white oak trees that are growing right next to each other, and they look like one single tree, and they're just beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful trees. I think of it as one tree. I see it every time I drive up and down Highway 61. If you're ever coming that way, look off to the west and notice the huge oak tree that really is two trees with a beautiful single crown, one organism. It's a beautiful thing to see. Now the March chapter. And this is about the understory, the leaf litter, and what all the life in the leaf litter. By the time March rolls around, most of the marcescent leaves on young oaks and immature oak branches have fallen from the tree, and the greater number of leaves that drop from mature branches in the fall have melded with those deposited under your oak in previous years to form the priceless organic layer we so inappropriately call litter. It is not at all obvious, but there is far more life under our oak trees than on them. Despite the many hundreds of species of moths and butterflies, katydids, walking sticks, tree crickets, lace bugs, cicadas, plant hoppers, tree hoppers, and gall wasps that depend on oaks, as well as all the mammals and birds that use oaks in one way or another during their life history, the diversity and abundance of the little creatures that reside in the leaf litter that accumulates beneath an oak is astounding and easily exceeds counts in the millions. Many of the inhabitants of oak leaf litter are barely visible to the naked eye, even though they are everywhere you look. But there's an easy way to observe some of the larger arthropods in the litter beneath your feet. Scrape away the top layer of leaves and nestle a white sheet of paper into the spot. After a minute or two, your paper will be dotted with dozens of springtails, mites smaller than a period, and whatever other species happen to find the paper in their path. What you are seeing is the vibrant community of decomposers, or, in the vernacular of soil ecologists, detritophores. These creatures that derive their nutrition from dead plant parts or from the bacteria and fungi that help break down the plant cellulose in those parts that is so difficult for animals to digest. And where there are thousands of detritivores, there are hundreds of detritivore predators keeping the community in trophic balance. The importance of the contribution these unobtrusive animals make to the greater web of life is unappreciated by most, but hard to overstate. Plants are the only organisms that can capture energy from the sun and convert it to food that sustains the rest of life. All plants require basic nutrients such as nitrogen, phosphorus, and iron, which they extract from the soil with their roots and use for growth and reproduction. These nutrients, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus, are often present in the soil in limited amounts and can easily become depleted if they are not returned to the soil after they are used. As a plant grows, nutrients become locked in its tissues, and unless they're released when the plant or its tissues die, they're no longer available for new plant growth. And that is the essential role of decomposers, to recycle the nutrients needed directly by plants and indirectly by nearly all animals. What is special about the 700,000 leaves that fall each year from a mature oak is that they create the very best type of leaf litter for sustaining decomposer populations. There are several reasons oak litter supports decomposers better than most other types of leaf litter. Top among these is its persistence. Most species of oak leaves decay very slowly once on the ground, consistently providing the housing, food, and humid conditions required by decomposers for up to 3 years. Because the litter is replenished annually, there are always plenty of leaves on the ground in various stages of decay under oaks. The same cannot be said for leaves from most other deciduous trees: maples, tulip trees, birches, aspens, cottonwoods, sweet gums, and hickories, just to name a few. All have thin leaves that decay relatively quickly once off the tree. In fact, the leaves of many trees decay so fast that they do not last through the summer until the next leaf fall. This is a serious problem for decomposers, very few of whom can survive for long on or in soil that is not covered by leaf litter. Not only does bare soil lack the organic material that sustains decomposers, it also rapidly loses the moisture on which the decomposer community depends. If leaf litter disappears, so do the decomposers, as well as the fungi and bacteria many eat, and the mycorrhizae that enable plant roots to absorb the nutrients they need. Oak leaves, in contrast, are loaded with lignins and tannins, which retard breakdown. Any leaf pack with a substantial proportion of oak leaves protects the ground and its diverse inhabitants year-round. The persistence of oak leaf litter provides another enormous ecological benefit. It improves water infiltration. The thick mat of leaf litter that characterizes forests with numerous oaks acts like a sponge when it rains, and it's most valuable when it rains hard. The water from a 2-inch downpour, for example, more than 54,000 gallons per acre, is captured almost entirely by an oak forest leaf litter and the organic humus it creates. And he goes on to talk about some of his oak memories. Through age 6, I lived on an oak-lined street in Plainfield, New Jersey. Each fall, my father would rake the leaves generated by these oaks from our small yard to the curb and burn them. Back then, burning seemed like an acceptable solution to the fall leaf problem. I, for one, loved this annual tradition. It was fun jumping into the huge leaf piles my father had raked up, and even more fun poking the leaf piles with sticks once they were alight. Most of all, I loved the smell created by burning oak leaves, and to this day, the smell of burning leaves conjures some of my best nostalgic memories. But leaf burning, as well as most other typical landscaping practices, slowly transformed our yard into an ecological dead zone. Gone were the millions of decomposers that our oak leaves could have nurtured, and the nutrients they would have returned to the soil were instead washed down the sewer with leaf ash during the first rain. Neither my father nor his neighbors thought about the simple yet intricate ways oak leaf litter could have contributed to watershed management in Plainfield, how the leaves we could have placed in beds about our yard would have helped to purify our groundwater, prevent destructive floods somewhere nearby, and create a healthy ecosystem in Meadowbrook, the small stream at the end of our street. The concept of ecosystem services had only recently occurred to the most forward-thinking ecologists, and it wasn't close to being part of the public discourse. It's been 62 years since my father burned our oak leaves, and in that time we have learned a great deal about what keeps the natural world afloat. Leaf burning is now banned in most towns because of the ensuing air pollution, and more people are discovering that leaves, particularly oak leaves, are superior mulch for flower beds and trees. Many townships gather leaves that homeowners don't want, compost them, and then offer them for free to homeowners who appreciate their ecological value. And fortunately, each year, there are fewer homeowners who cut down magnificent oaks simply because they have grown tired of raking leaves. It has become clear to me that developing a sustainable relationship with the oaks in our landscapes will lead us to a sustainable relationship with the natural world on which we all depend. Every day I see signs that our society is, in fact, learning how to do this. And that's the end of the March chapter. There's an organization I want to tell you about. I just found out about it. I learned about it from Margaret Renkel's column in the New York Times. It's a website. It's an organization called homegrownnationalpark.org. I love the title, Homegrown National Park. We can all be part of. And Doug Tallamy is part of this organization. He's a co-founder. I urge you to look at this website, homegrownnationalpark.org. Lots and lots of fun information here. So I hope you're interested in starting to get rid of some of the invasives and starting to plant some oak trees. I've been reading from the book The Nature of Oaks by Douglas Tallamy, T-A-L-L-A-M-Y, published by the Timber Press in Portland, Oregon. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.